PPI.org.
Evening. Thank you for joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research team, and I'm the engineer tonight. Woohoo! I'm actually back in the studio, as that permits. That is always good. Tonight, we're speaking about HIV and the research that's going on. Dr. Tim Schacker is Vice Dean of Research at the University of Minnesota Medical School and lead author on the HIV study. We're going to be talking about... Good evening, Dr. Schacker.
Good evening. It's good to be here.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate that. Let's see. So first of all, I'm trying to make sure I have you on okay. Talk a little bit about how you got into this particular... You know, what your background is as far as and how you chose this particular branch of medicine.
Oh, sure. So way back when I was a medical student, I distinctly remember sitting in the student lounge and reading an issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. And there was the description of the first people in, I believe it was Los Angeles, with an unusual form of cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma. And they were, the only thing that they had in common is that they were all gay men. And then shortly after that came the news of in New York City with the pneumocystis, with the unusual form of pneumonia. And so it just caught my attention. I have always been interested in infectious diseases, microbiology, and as I progressed through residency, it's just the one thing that kept coming back to me as being of the most interest. And so when it came time to choose a specialty or a subspecialty, I chose infectious disease, and I wanted to go to a place where I could learn as much as possible about human virology and HIV. So I went to Seattle, the University of Washington in Seattle.
Ah, excellent. Well, I started growing up in Washington State, so beautiful place. Yes. Talk a bit about what is HIV. I think, you know, if you were around in the 80s, you heard about it a lot. And now you don't hear so much. So what does HIV mean?
HIV, human immunodeficiency virus, is an infection. It's a particular kind of virus, just like the cause of COVID-19 mm-hmm. is a coronavirus called SARS-CoV-2. HIV is a retrovirus, so it belongs to a different family of viruses. And it is transmitted fairly easily through contact with infected fluids, body fluids. And so it's a sexually transmitted infection. It can be transmitted through transfusions. It can be, that's the main way that it's passed. It's descendant from another virus called simian immunodeficiency virus, which is an infection in rhesus macaques, or it's an infection in monkeys.
Ah.
And so HIV is a cousin of SIV and is the descendant, actually, of SIV. And it's thought that the jump from monkeys to humans occurred in sub-Saharan Africa, probably in about the 1930s. And there's pretty good evidence now to show that that's about the timeline. And it was known during the 50s and 60s, it was known in sub-Saharan Africa as Slim's disease. And what it does is it, because of the unique cell that it infects, viruses have to infect cells to survive. Mm-hmm. It infects a particular cell in your immune system and destroys that cell as a function. And that's what causes the symptoms and the disease we now call AIDS, the acquired immune deficiency syndrome. And the way that I talk to patients about it is when they get infected, the cell that gets infected, it's called the CD4 T cell or the T helper cell. And that's the cell that is like the orchestra conductor of your immune system. It really is what keeps the outside world out. It's what controls your second skin. And as those cells go away, holes appear in that second skin, and in unusual infections and cancers can take over. And that's really what happens in HIV infection. So it really didn't come to our attention until it got into a particular population, and in this case, men who have sex with men, it was amplified, for whatever reason, it was amplified in that population, and this came to light in the 80s, in the early 80s, and the understanding of the infection grew, people started to put together connect the dots sort of thing, to understand that, people who got transfusions, for example, mm-hmm. and in that time it was hemophiliacs who got a lot of transfusions,
yes.
and they became a segment of the population that had HIV. And then the dots were connected again to Slim's disease in sub-Saharan Africa, and the story unfolded so that by the early 90s we had a reasonably good idea of what this infection was, how it was how it is transmitted, and that began the real search for how does this disease cause the condition we know as AIDS, and of course once we understood that, it became more clear how to develop drugs to combat it, and that began the industry that we know as the antiretroviral drug industry, or the drugs that we use to treat people with HIV or living with HIV, and now today, most of my patients are on one pill once a day. Each of those pills contains three or four different drugs. But back in the early 90s, and mid 90s, we were prescribing regimens where folks living with HIV were taking 24 to 32 pills a day.
That's amazing.
In 6-hour intervals.
We'll get to more of that treatment. I'm okay. Curious to know, I always heard about needle sharing, and that's one of the things that I always... My understanding was that was a cause too. How big is that a problem in the HIV?
So needle sharing is a significant form, or is a significant cause of transmission of HIV, especially in it is a significant cause of HIV transmission, and so it isn't a mystery. The syringes get contaminated
yep.
with blood, and if they contain blood with HIV, then you're injecting it into the next person.
Right. Can we talk about symptoms? What are symptoms of HIV?
So in the untreated individual, we think about them in probably three different ways.
Mm-hmm.
During the acute stage, when you first get infected, it's very much like mono. Only, the patients will tell you it's the sickest they've ever felt in their life. but it's symptoms of mononucleosis. So it's big swollen lymph nodes, it's high spiking fevers, it's, you know, those kinds of things. And those last, those symptoms last, you know, probably up to 14 days, and then they resolve. And the patient at that point, the person living with HIV at that point, enters what's called the chronic phase. So they go from acute to chronic. And in the early chronic stage of the disease or of the infection, it's you know, they might get a few more colds. They might get shingles, for example, mm-hmm. And that sort of thing. In certain parts of the world where TB, tuberculosis, is much more common, prevalent, they might reactivate tuberculosis. If they have herpes simplex, either in the lips or in the genital region, those might reactivate cold sores, for example, might reactivate more often. So it's pretty common, manageable sorts of infections, and it's mostly infections. As the disease progresses, as the infection progresses, and the CD4 T cell count, that second skin, fades even more, more complicated problems emerge. So thrush, for example, a yeast infection in your throat, it would be pretty common. More severe herpes. In the early days, you know, we saw, it wasn't unusual to see people with drug-resistant herpes infections and that kind of thing. But once your CD4 count gets below a certain level that's pretty low, that's what we call clinical AIDS. And that's where the opportunistic infections and malignancies occur. And so this is a well-defined set of diseases and infections, and your CD4 count has to be pretty low at that point. And so those are things like pneumocystis pneumonia, certain infections that affect your brain, cancers are a part of this, so lymphomas and that kind of thing. And eventually, you know, the person, usually, if they're not treated, will die of one of these opportunistic infections or malignancies.
I'm wondering, it seems like people may go through this in different paces. Like it wouldn't make people necessarily ill the same pace of time. So when did you guys usually see somebody coming in? At what point? I mean, I'm sure there's all different points, but how would one know to go get checked for that?
So in the early days when we didn't have antiretrovirals, it was more common to see people coming in when they had very advanced disease. Mm. in university clinics, where often there was a lot of research going on, patients were, or people living with HIV were typically identified a little bit earlier. But now, today, it's much more common to diagnose somebody with really early HIV infection. So just because people are more aware, and they're also aware that if they start therapy, that they should be starting therapy as quickly as possible. So now people who come in who are diagnosed, typically their CD4 count is much higher. They really haven't had much of a problem. And we start them on antiretrovirals, and that typically stops the progression of the disease.
We need to take a short station break, and I want to remind everyone that this is Pledge Night. Please feel free to call 612-375-9030. Also, go on the website at kfai.org. It's safe and secure. Give what you can. This show runs by you, and we depend on your support. So please give. Dr. Shacker, I wonder if, you know, I'm going to skip back to when we were really hearing a lot about this in the 80s and the 90s, and the statistics seemed astronomically high. But now you really don't hear as much anymore. Have the statistics really changed, or is it just that you don't hear as much about it anymore?
It depends on where in the world you live. We need to acknowledge that in the United States, there's still about 36, 37,000 new infections per year. But if you just step back and say, you know, worldwide, what has happened and is happening, overall, there have been 80 million people infected with HIV. 36 million of those people have already died. That means 38 million people are living with HIV, and most of those people are living in places where resources are really constrained. If you go to KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, you know, it's one in three or one in four women are HIV infected. And that statistic hasn't changed. And really what that is access to healthcare and access to antiretrovirals. You know, now, a few years ago, it was appalling how few people worldwide had access to antiretrovirals. That's changed significantly in the last 5 to 10 years. And I think the current statistic is that up to, I think 40%, if you go outside of Europe, the United States, probably 40% of people have access or are on antiretrovirals. But we have a long way to go. And so what you're seeing is that the number of people living with HIV is going up, and they're living longer because they're on antiretrovirals. But there's still large portions of the world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, South Africa, where this is just a huge, huge problem. And then there's other parts of the world where we really don't know what is happening. Parts of Asia, Central Asia, Russia, it's really not clear what the status of the infection is in those parts of the world.
So what I hear you saying is that the numbers are still going up, but that there's more ability to care for these numbers.
So they're actually not going up, but there's still a significant number of people infected every year.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is there a race and or gender preference that this tends to be higher in?
Yes. And so I can give you good numbers for the United States. It's probably very similar in Europe.
Okay.
In that, you know, close to half of new infections every year, 45%, are in people who are Black or African American. Mm-hmm. So if you just look at it as, you know, Caucasian versus not Caucasian, 24% are Caucasian and 77% are not, or 76% are not. In the United States, 20% of all new infections are in women. And that's that's a mix of injection drug use or a partner of somebody who's an injection drug user, mm-hmm. Most commonly. And then if you look at the age, this is I think, still something that is doesn't get as much attention as it should. Mm. Almost 70% of new infections in the United States are in people who are less than 40 years old.
Really?
And 35 to 40% of those people are in their 20s.
Wow.
So it is a infection of young people, and that is, you know, there are public health measures that work. There are medical interventions that work at prevention. And so I think we need to do a better job of getting that message out there to protect our young people.
I was going to ask, I was like, you know, this isn't, unless you're, HIV is something that is heard of, and you would think that people would understand at least some of the things you'd need to do. Is it just purely, you think, educational that is going on, or is it cultural? What is happening that people are not?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above. You know, one of the striking differences between COVID and HIV in terms of the response to the infection. This has been true since the very beginning of the HIV epidemic or pandemic. And it is that the older folks in the community. So in if it's the men who have sex with men community, the older folks really become the teachers of the younger folks and guide them into how not to get infected. You know, you don't see that. You don't see that kind of wanting to help one another as much in COVID. So, you know, it is an education gap, but it's also a access to care gap. I mean, a lot of these kids are homeless. A lot of these kids are experimenting with injection drugs. A lot of these kids are, you know, struggling with gender identity, and I don't think we're helping them very well. And so, you know, we've got, you know, just witness what's happening in Florida. We've got pre-exposure prophylaxis that works and works well at preventing infection. We've got post-exposure prophylaxis that works and works well to prevent infection. We know about the, just like we know that masks work for COVID, condoms mm-hmm. work for transmission of HIV. Access to clean needles works for preventing transmission of HIV. We've got a lot of tools in the toolkit. It's just, number one, having the ability to use them, getting the word out, and, you know, giving these folks access to those tools.
I do want to let listeners know, if they just stumbled on, and I probably should have said this at the beginning, this may be a sensitive topic to some people. So guide yourself in what you feel you may want young ears to hear. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. This is Pledge Drive. So you may visit us at KFAI.org or call 612-375-9030. And we're speaking with Dr. Shacker, who is talking about HIV and the studies. Dr. Shacker, I wonder, I always hear it, HIV and AIDS. So I know there must be a difference, and I think I get confused with the difference. So can you lay it out a little better for the lay people that hear that sure. in conjunctions? What is the differences between the two?
So HIV is the virus that you get infected with. Mm-hmm. AIDS is the clinical syndrome that's caused by the infection. Just like SARS-CoV-2 is the infection, is the virus that you get infected with, COVID are the symptoms that you get as a result of SARS-CoV-2 infection. So it's the same difference. So HIV is a virus, you get infected with it, causes damage to your immune system, you get AIDS. And that's the clinical, it's a clinical definition.
So let's talk longevity. I think that, you know, when you were talking about, when you guys kind of first started out, or, you know, 30 years ago, when people were taking 20 or, you know, several sure. doses of medication, they did not, you often heard about people dying quite young from this, but it's sure. clear that the longevity part, that people are living longer, much longer, actually, it seems. Give us some insight onto that.
Yeah, in the pre-antiretroviral area, and so in the era before we had any drugs, the natural history studies that were done showed that on average, people from the time that they got infected until they died of the disease was somewhere in the 7 to 10 year range, mm-hmm. probably closer to 7 years. And that can vary a lot. We know that there are people who get infected and have almost a normal lifespan without any drug intervention at all, the long-term non-progressors. And we've got people who get infected and die within 6 to 9 months, the so-called rapid progressors. Those are very few. Most people, it was in that 7 to 10 year range. As we get into the era in the 90s where we had drugs but that weren't very effective, you know, that stretched out a little bit longer. And now in today's era, where we've got what I think are probably pretty effective drugs at suppressing the virus, you know, we're saying that people aren't going to have normal lifespans probably, but they're going to have close to normal lifespans. And so we've still got work to do, but if you just look at what has been accomplished, especially in when you're talking about an infectious disease like HIV, and the fact that, you know, the target that you're looking at, you know, we have well over 35 licensed antiretrovirals now, and that's all been done just in the you know, in a 20-25 year period, and that's a remarkable accomplishment. So we've gone from HIV being a death sentence for 98% of people to it being a, you know, manageable chronic condition, assuming you take your medications, for most people who have access to those medications.
I think when you started out, you know, in the 80s and whatnot, the HIV was it was such a taboo or sensitive subject. And if anybody knew somebody who had it, it was a very alienating, you know,
yes,
disease. Has that changed now, or is it, how's that treated?
So, it's, you know, it is talked about much more openly.
Mm-hmm.
There are some, you know, some patients that I've worked with over the years, have had, you know, a really open relationship with their family, and they talk about it. But, you know, even today in clinic, I had a young guy who's afraid to tell his parents just because of the stigma associated with HIV infection. And that's, I don't like using these kinds of words, but it's not uncommon. It's frequent that I have this conversation with people who just got diagnosed with HIV. There's still a stigma. It's not like it was many years ago, but it's still out there.
We need to take another short break, but while we're doing that, I want to encourage you out there, listeners, to go to kfai.org and please show us your support. We do depend on that to do what we're doing, and we bring you many great guests throughout our year, and I hear comments from you on the emails, so please go and donate, kfai.org or 612-375-9030. So, Dr. Shacker, I'm always amazed at what is happening, and I'm very happy to see that these studies are progressing, because even though I understand and I actually even fear COVID. All I hear is COVID, 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 as I'm sure everyone out there is hearing. And it is nice to be able to read the stuff that is happening, that's still going on, and that not everything is concentrating on that. I just want to talk about the current studies that are happening. The treatments have, as you said, have changed from 30 years ago. And now you're saying it's down to, like you said, one pill a day?
Yes.
But now there's these current studies that I read, and I think if you're going to have to correct me, because I think it's three people now that have been cured. Is this what I should understand?
Yes.
And what does the term cured mean to you?
Well, that's a really good question, and one that there's not wide agreement in the field on. We talk about two different forms of cure. One is that there is no evidence of the virus anywhere in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really high bar. The other is that you could take somebody off of their drugs, their antiretrovirals,
mm-hmm.
and there would be no evidence of virus replication in the blood, and there would be no progression of the disease. So they're still infected. They still have the virus. But, you know, you're able to in effect, restore immune function to keep it at bay.
Ah.
And, you know, so that's an important distinction. With the three individuals that you're talking about, most of us believe that they were actually cured, that there was no evidence for the virus in their body after the treatments that they had. Most of the studies that are going on today that are in the what we call the cure agenda they're really looking more at what we call the functional cure, training the immune system to just totally control virus from replicating, mm-hmm. not trying to totally eradicate it.
So let's go and talk a little bit about the first two studies. Were they done at once? The two males, I think, right?
Right.
Were they done at the same time?
No. The first patient, I can't remember the exact year, but he was an individual. He's since died of other causes. He's an individual who was living abroad and developed a particularly aggressive form of leukemia that is it is one of those opportunistic malignancies that's known in HIV infection. And so when he had his leukemia, he required not one, but two bone marrow transplants. And what they did was, in order to do a bone marrow transplant for leukemia, often they do really aggressive things, total body irradiation, chemotherapy to get rid of all of the immune cells. Mm. And so these are really, really toxic therapies that are life-saving if you need them, but they have a pretty high mortality rate. And what they did with this first patient, and actually the subsequent patients, is that they took advantage of what you could call a chink in the virus's armor. They were able to put cells back into the patient that the virus simply couldn't infect. It didn't have the right machinery to infect those cells. And there's a small, it's a very interesting story, it goes back to the plague actually, but there's a small percent of people who have cells that simply can't get HIV infected. Ah. And so what they did was when they did the transplant, they gave him, both gentlemen actually, they gave cells that were this modified, they were cells that simply couldn't get infected with HIV. And so the cells that repopulated and restored their immune system were impervious to the infection. And over time, any cells that remained that were infected, they just died. And so that's why I say we think that they were really actually cured of the infection. And a lot of studies that were done on these folks, we participated in those studies and, contributed to the literature that says we can't find it in them.
So, I'm sorry, keep going.
No, I was just going to say the circumstances with the third patient they're a little bit different, but the story is the same.
So
transplanted with cells that couldn't get infected.
So, but the first cancer. With the first two, with the two males, how far apart were they done?
Oh, years, years.
So they did them. You said approximately the same way. Were they? Is it like immunotherapy type?
No, it's chemotherapy. So there's it's a good question. It's chemotherapy. It's basically just blasting all of the cells of the immune system away so that there's none left. And then you put new cells in that can't get HIV infected. You're never going to completely get rid of all of the cells.
Right.
But you're going to get rid of 99% of them or some huge proportion. And the cells that you put back in, if they can't get infected with HIV, the cells that remain that happen to have a virus in them, they're going to die. And they can't spread the infection to other cells.
So
immunotherapy is when you train the immune system to be more effective. And that's much more modern than what happened with those folks.
So did they do anything different between the two?
Not effectively. There were differences in the amount of chemo that were used and that sort of thing, but the strategy is the same.
And what were the side effects? There must have been some side effects with this.
Oh my gosh. So I'm not a transplant physician, but I've taken care of a lot of the infectious disease complications of transplant. you're basically taking away their immune system, and you're blasting them with radiation and chemotherapy. And so there's all kinds of potential for infections to take hold, for the immune system as it recovers to really rebel against the immune system you're trying to put in them. and that causes a host of problems. That's why I say, you know, this is not something that's exportable. This is not something that we would just recommend for anybody. This is only if you have a really aggressive cancer that's going to kill you, would we recommend this approach to curing HIV. But what it shows in principle is that this can be done. And if you take apart all the components of, you know, what is done, you eliminate the reservoir, you put cells back in that can't be infected, you support that person, you know, there are probably ways, we haven't come up with them yet, but there are probably ways to duplicate that are far less toxic. But that's I think, where the field is at right now.
And both the males are deceased now?
I only know about the first one. I'm not certain about the second one.
And were they both done because they had cancer and they needed I see. Okay. So
yes.
It was almost maybe an accident that they discovered.
No, it was in both of those patients, it was intentional. We've known for some time that there are these cells in a certain proportion of the population that can't get infected with HIV. So there are folks who have been exposed multiple times to HIV and they've never gotten infected. And it's just, it's a certain genetic modification on their T cells that the virus just can't land on them. It can't take hold. And so the decision was made when it was clear that this person, to survive their cancer, was going to need a transplant. They were able to find a donor who matched enough of their immune system, but they had cells that couldn't get infected.
So the third one was a woman.
Yes.
And it was actually done differently, right? It was cord.
I'm not real familiar with all the intricacies, but the theme is the same. She had a cancer that was going to kill her. They were able to put cells back in her that couldn't get infected. They had more modern approaches that did include immunotherapy, but it's still the same. It's get rid of the reservoir, get rid of the immune system that's infected, put an immune system back in that can't get reinfected, and then support the person.
My understanding was that she did much better in regards to the side effects because of the way the treatment went that time.
Yeah. So again, it is the more modern approach, the use of immunotherapy and that sort of thing. But the really important message here is that this is an approach that really can only be used in people who have malignancies, cancers that are going to kill them, and that, you know, we have access to cells that can't get infected. You know, the chemotherapy, the radiation, the immunotherapy, those are going to change over time. It might be a little less toxic, et cetera, but it's still, the idea is still the same.
So what do you want people to take away from these studies that are coming out?
Well, from those three examples, we know that in principle, HIV can be cured. It's not going to be for very many people because of the inherent toxicities of the way that we have to go about it. It's three people so far,
getting access to cells that'll
survive in people that can't get infected. That's pretty rare. But, you know, when I said putting cells back in that can't get infected, well, some very clever folks realized that they could take CD4 cells from people and gene modify them. So they're using genetic manipulation and removing the receptor. You know, they're removing the part of the cell that the virus needs, so that they're actually mimicking the, you know, what was done in those patients. And now that we're getting immunotherapy that's far less toxic, but, you know, can support those cells, there are ways that are being looked at to, you know, gradually increase the proportion of the cells in the body that can't get infected. And as that happens, so this is a long ways off, but there are humans, you know, we're doing these studies in humans today. So, you know, it's pretty remarkable, actually. It's just the point that these three patients have taught the field an enormous amount. They've shown us the path. We now have to figure out how to do it in a way that is much, much less toxic, and is going to be much safer for the patient. Because honestly, at least in the Western world, you know, folks have access to therapy that's going to give them an almost normal lifespan. So things that we come up with can't be things that, you know, there's a 30% chance it's going to kill you.
So it brings me to this topic of gene editing, which presumably Yes. The story is that that has already been done. What is the people who are doing the studies' feelings on something that could be edited and fixed, maybe?
Well, so I want to be really clear about this. These are very early days.
Uh-huh.
Gene therapy as a field, you know, there's only a couple of examples. And it's not in HIV where gene therapy has successfully fixed the problem. And so this is, like I said, this is very early days. But, if the goal is to eradicate the reservoir of infected cells and replace them with cells that can't get infected, you know, probably the most straightforward way to do that is with genetic engineering of human CD4 cells. The rate of progress in this research is accelerating. We're getting much more accepting of the way to do these kinds of clinical studies, but it's still really, really very early days.
I wonder, you always hear about things that just, you know, myths with HIV and whatnot that are not true. Are there any that you know of that you can share with listeners that, you know, would kind of help things?
So I'm sorry, I missed that. The
myths. Myths or examples of HIV, myths of things that are not true in regards to it.
Early in the pandemic, you know, there was lots of misinformation. Now I don't hear as much of that. It could be out there and I just don't know it. We know the virus, we know how it's transmitted. I think there's wide acceptance of that. We've got good therapies for it. I think where the barriers are, if that's part of the question, the barriers in our country and in Europe are still the feeling that if you've got HIV, somehow that, you know, you could have avoided that and, you know, that kind of thing. In the rest of the world, it's the experience that I've had and the work that I've done in Africa, anyway, is that, you know, if you give people the tools, they will use them. They will use them. But it's just getting that out into the hands of the people that need it. And there's a lot of barriers to that. There's a lot of people. There's the information systems are not as good. You know, it's that kind of barrier. But as far as the misinformation in this country, I just don't see it as much as I used to.
I have my research person that is with us, Charlene. I just want to make sure she didn't have any questions in regards to this topic. So, Charlene?
I really don't. I was working at the VA when this whole stuff came around in the 80s, and it changed the dynamics big time. And now I don't work there anymore, but I'm hearing that now it's just another thing that happens to people, and they treat it and they move on.
Well, so I want to put a cautionary tale around what you said is, I think, mostly true. When I was a med student at one of our local hospitals, you know, the residents had to be convinced that they should go in to take care of these poor kids because nobody really knew how it was transmitted. And there was a lot of discrimination as a result of that. And that's I think, much less true I just don't see it as much. I see it a little bit. But this idea that it is, you know, you just, there you are, and you'll take your pills and you'll move on. These pills are not without side effects. These folks do not have a normal immune system. They're still at risk for some challenges and problems. And everyone that I've talked to has said, you know, if we could cure this, boy, I'd take that in a heartbeat.
So do people with HIV, do they have a shortened lifespan?
So the data are evolving on that. 5 years ago, I would say absolutely. It is, you know, what we would say is an almost normal lifespan. Today, with the therapies that we've got, we just don't know if that's improved things or not. But the data from a few years ago were pretty clear that, you know, it dramatically improved the length of time that people could live with HIV.
And when you say almost normal lifespan, are they dying how a typical HIV person might die, from like something that they have gotten because of their immunity, or is it?
Yeah, that's kind of the challenge to that, because there's a couple of things we know about HIV infection in people who are treated with today's drugs. Mm-hmm. HIV is still a infection that causes this phenomenon of accelerated aging. So the frailty index tends to be higher. The biochemical studies that are done on some of these folks show that the whatever marker of accelerated aging you want to use, it just seems to be that they are aging faster. It's also a disease of chronic inflammation. So, you know, we know, for example, with people who have heart attacks, sometimes there are, you know, we attribute that sometimes to inflammatory conditions.
Right.
And we know that in HIV infection, even today in our well-treated individuals, there's a subset of people who are more likely to have blood clots, who are more likely to have heart attacks.
Yes.
And we're still having trouble parsing out who those people are. You know, what are the markers that say you're at increased risk? We'll pay more attention to that. But so, you know, when we say near normal lifespan and they're dying of a heart attack, you know, was that because they were going to have a heart attack anyway, or because they were HIV infected and had this pro-inflammatory condition? So I think, you know, there's a lot of really important work that's going into teasing that out. But you got to step back and say, okay, we're going to do that work. But look, you know, we went 30 years ago from a disease that was a death sentence to almost a near normal lifespan. And that's a, you know, every few years, you know, we're making dramatic improvements in that. So there's a whole area of research right now that, you know, we call the HIV cure agenda. And, you know, we think that if we can bring people to a functional cure where we can take them off their meds, where their immune system is enough restored that it's going to control viral replication, that inflammatory conditions are going to go down, we think that's going to be a big improvement in how people live their lives.
Does diet and or exercise play into anything, as well as how people deal with the medication that they get and how they, you know, how long they live with the HIV?
So I believe that diet and exercise always improve disease outcomes.
Yes.
Always. And that is true with HIV. You know, the most effective anti-aging approach that we have, it doesn't matter if you're HIV infected or not, is daily exercise. If you get good exercise, you're going to slow down the aging process. Those data seem pretty clear. So yes, I think that there is no question that having a healthy diet, getting regular exercise, will significantly improve your lot on life.
I have one more question. Can a pregnant woman give the HIV virus to their unborn child?
Yes.
Wow.
Are there things that can stop that?
There's a lot of caveats to that. Some don't. We've got safe and effective antiretroviral therapy now that we can give to pregnant women, and you know there's little to no risk to the fetus for doing that, and that prevents the infection. And we have really well developed and effective tools to monitor the baby after they're born to see if they did acquire the infection, and if they did, then you know they can be treated. But I have to tell you that in our country, the incidence of vertical transmission, you know, from mom to baby, mm-hmm. has dramatically gone down. It's where you see it more, obviously, is in parts of the world that just simply don't have access to antiretroviral therapy.
And so I'm presuming this, so correct me if I'm wrong, if the mother is on the viral therapy and they've had a child, that they would not nurse. Would they pass it that way?
Yeah. So I'm not a pediatrician, and this science has evolved a lot in the last few years. My understanding of it is, yes, you can transmit from nursing, and in parts of the world, that is a lifeline for the baby. And so if the mom is on antiretrovirals, the incidence of transmission is dramatically decreased. But again, I just don't know the most recent data on that.
Gotcha. Dr. Shacker, we have to wrap it up, and thank you so very much for our endless questioning with this.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
It's a great topic, and good luck with the research. And I hope you're back on in another handful of years to talk about more new things that are happening with this.
That sounds great. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, sir. This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Thanks so much for tuning in. This is Pledge Night, so we are encouraging you to go pledge. 612-375-9030 or KFAI.org. We have been speaking with Dr. Tim Shacker. Dr. Shacker was a Vice Dean of Research at the University of Minnesota, University of Minnesota Medical School, and also the author on the HIV studies that have been happening. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. If you want to be on our email list, you may email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Charlene Dahl is my research team, and my name is Sam. I've been the host and producer of the show tonight. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Heavy world pressing down. KFAI.org.